You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. An amazing study out of Credit Suisse. You know that foreign bank that donates to Paul Ryan's campaign? I thought foreigners couldn't influence U.S. elections. No. Actually, they're in his top 20 donors. But, you know, hey, that's life these days. Credit Suisse says that the median income, now the median income, the median wage in the United States, the median income in the United States right now is $25,600 a year. So in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $26,000 a year. That's where half of the population makes more than that. Half of the population makes less than that. And when you look at households, it's around a little over $40,000 a year. But for individuals, it's $25,000 to $26,000. When you look at wealth, though, that's what people own. Median wealth, half the country owns more, half the country owns less. In Australia, median wealth is a little over $210,000, right in the middle. In Italy, it's a little over $160,000. In Japan, it's around $140,000. In the United Kingdom, it's around $130,000. In Switzerland, it's right at $100,000. Same for Ireland. In Greece, it's about $90,000. Canada, $90,000. Norway, $89,000. Let's see. It's kind of hard to read this small type here. Finland, around $88,000. Spain, $80,000. New Zealand, $75,000. The Netherlands, $73,000. Israel in the 70s. Taiwan in the, all of these are over 100,000. I missed that. The numbers here are 10000. My numbers are right. And then we get down to Germany. It's, around 20,000. The United States median wealth is, we're number 17 in the world. I'm going to have to pull this chart out and get the numbers. All of those countries that I just named are massively higher than us. So what the heck is going on? I thought we were the richest country in the world. Logan Clements is with us. It's Clements?
Clements.
Logan?
Yes, thanks for having me.
And it's pronounced Clements. You are a filmmaker and CEO of Freestar Media and objectivist, as in follower of Ayn Rand, objectivist.org. Your website, freestarmedia.com. And I understand you've produced a new anti-Obama movie.
Yeah, my movie is called Sick and Sicker, as in the U.S. healthcare market is sick, but Canadians are market is even sicker.
Okay, all right, great. So we're number 15. Is this going to really resonate? You know, we weren't number 15 before Reagan came into office. Before Reagan came into office, we had the healthiest middle class in the world. Today, we have one of the least healthy middle classes. And Australia, Italy, Japan, the UK, they all beat us by more than 3 to 1, almost 4 to 1.
Who's currently the president, Tom?
Well, it's not the question of who's the president. If you want to turn this into a partisan debate, you know, we can do that. But I'm looking at this from a policy point of view.
You mentioned Reagan. I don't know if I'm in a time capsule here or something. I thought Barack Obama was the president.
Well, the principal things that cause these countries to have good, healthy median incomes are that their top tax rates are over 50%. When Reagan came into office, the top tax rate was 74%. He dropped it down to 28%. And thus began the race to the top for the top 1% and the race to the bottom for all the rest of us. And it's just continued for 30 years. I mean, we're still practicing Reaganomics. Even President Obama, to a certain extent, is practicing Reaganomics. So, you know, what I don't get is how objectivists and libertarians and Republicans want to continue this when the consequences of such massive wealth inequality and the collapse of a middle class are so obvious. Our schools are going to hell. Our culture, our society is falling apart. Our middle class is in a crisis right now because of these insane Reaganomics policies.
So let me get this straight, Tom. You believe that if the government raises taxes, it makes people richer? Is that correct?
I don't just believe that. I can demonstrate that. And by people, if you mean the vast majority of the people, the bottom 99%, yes. If you're talking about the top 1%, no, that's not the case. When Reagan came into office, the top 1%, the average CEO, the Mitt Romney's dad, George Romney, was making 31 times what his average employee is making. Right now, the average CEO in the non-financial industry is making 530 times what their employees are making. And on Wall Street, they're making 10 to 14,000 times what their employees are making. In my opinion, that shouldn't be, and that's a direct consequence of tax policy.
The same amount of wealth. Do you think that there's a problem with the fact that we don't all have the same amount of wealth? Do you think that's the problem, that we're not all at the same exact level?
No, of course not. That would be a stupid way to put it. But I do think that there's a problem with the level of inequality that we have. It's not all or nothing.
Why are we talking about this subject, and why are you even bringing it up?
Because the inequality, nobody would say we should all be at the exact same level of wealth. Come on, that's a parallel question. The question is, do I believe that the rich should not be as rich as they are and that the middle class should be richer as it was before Reagan? Yes, I absolutely do.
Okay, so basically you have a problem with the fact that some people have more wealth than other people. Is that correct?
I have a problem with the proportions of the disproportion of this. We and Singapore are the two of the developed countries in the world. I mean, you know, if you want to throw us into the mix, we're in there with Rhodesia, or now a former Rhodesia, whatever Zimbabwe is called now. But the fact of the matter is that we are among the two most unequal countries in the world in terms of our rich are richer and our poor are poorer, and our middle class, as a consequence of that, has been getting progressively poorer. And I'm just wondering what your solution to that is. Or do you think that that's just fine?
There's not a problem if people don't have the same amount of wealth, okay? Now, here's the situation. If a person gets wealthy, not by initiating force, not by using the law to take money to get some kind of monopoly or something like that given to them by the government, there's no problem if they get wealthy.
Well, there's no wealthy person in America who has not used the law, Logan.
But you're advocating as a progressive, where you want the government to control the economy more, where you want the government to have higher taxes and control everything more.
I'm not suggesting the former. I am suggesting the latter.
Because when the government controls more and more of the economy,
I'm not suggesting
the way that you get rich in a society like that, Tom Hartman, is you give a lot of donations to the politicians that have all the power over the economy, and that's how you get rich.
And yet that's what's happening right now. That's not what was happening before Reagan.
Why are we talking about Reagan?
Because
Obama is currently the president. Let's talk about Barack Obama's policies, Tom.
Because Reagan came in and nailed down this ideology which we are still living with today. We still have the top income tax rate in this country has been below 50% since 1986. And we've had just a continuous train wreck ever since. I'm saying roll back the Reagan tax cuts.
Tom,
I don't hear a solution from your side.
Here's what government does. Government takes away our freedom.
I don't hear a solution from your side.
Money.
I don't hear a solution from your side.
Destroys economies. I'll tell you what my solution is. Reduce the size and scope of government as much as possible. Because rich
people the billionaires can get even bigger.
Rich people can get over all the hurdles that you, would, as a progressive, would throw in front of the economy. They can hire lawyers to get past the regulations and to pay the taxes. It's your policies, these so-called progressive policies, that keep people poor. Because when a poor person wants to break out of poverty, maybe they want to start a little restaurant or a little business. And guess what, Tom? The types of policies that you advocate keep people down.
So the reason why America used to have every town, every mall used to have small locally owned businesses before Reagan. In 81, he stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. He deregulated the government. And now you no longer have small family businesses. That's because of too much regulation?
Of course. Who do you think regulation hurts the most? A big company like General Electric has lots of lawyers to deal with these regulations. A mom-and-pop restaurant can't afford to deal with all these regulations.
Logan Clements,
Tom Hartman Program.
You can read all about it over at freestarmedia.com or objectivist.org. Thank you, Logan.
Rich men in a darkened room, making plans to fuel the corporate boom. Flowers of evil begin to bloom in a rich man's world.
You know, I think that it's going to come as an incredible shock to most Americans that we're not the richest nation in the world. I mean, America likes to think of itself as the richest nation on the planet. And it's basically considered common knowledge. Hey, which country is the richest on earth? America, of course. We hear it from our politicians, our school teachers, our news media. And looking strictly at total combined wealth, we are the richest by a lot. According to a 2011 study by Allianz, the United States has over $41 trillion in combined wealth. Second is Japan, with far less than half the wealth of the United States, just over $14 trillion. So we're number one, right? Well, not exactly. Our nation's combined wealth is astronomically high, but that's only because there are a heck of a lot of billionaires living here. In fact, about a third of the world's billionaires live right here in the United States. 412 of them. Second on the list is China with 115. So our total wealth is inflated by all the billionaires who live here. If you want to truly measure, hang on just a second, let me just, there we go. If you want to truly measure how wealthy the United States actually is, then you have to look at median wealth, or how much Americans in the middle are making, where half are making more and half are making less. Under that criteria, the United States doesn't even crack the top 10 in the world. According to a report by Credit Suisse, 15 OECD nations have higher median wealth than the United States. That includes Australia, Japan, Israel. It includes European nations that are in a crisis right now, like Spain, Italy, and Ireland. Their middle class is still doing okay. That's because over the 30 years since we embraced Reaganomics, our middle class has been devastated. And the countries that rank ahead of us, even the ones that are in the middle of a debt crisis in Europe, they haven't sold out their middle class. What are these countries with higher median wealth have in common? Universal health care, strong labor unions, generous social safety nets, and high income taxes. All the things that we used to have here in the United States, aside from universal health care, until Reagan came along in the 80s, declared war on organized labor, and went to work undoing the New Deal. So that today, we're not the wealthiest nation on the planet anymore. We just have the most Romney-level rich. And that, in my opinion, is the problem. I mean, this is a serious crisis. When you look at the consequences of inequality like this, it's pretty mind-boggling. About one-third of the annual deaths in the United States, according to epidemiological researchers. And you could, by the way, you can get this information over at inequality.org. The statistics are right there. You can track it right back to the source. About a third of annual deaths in the United States are credited to inequality. It's really quite remarkable. A huge share of the nation's economic growth over the last 30 years has gone to the top 100th of 1%, who make an average of $27 million per household. The average income for the bottom 90%, $31,244, and that's the average. The median is around $25,000. In the United States, 22% of all kids are in poverty. We are second only to that of Mexico. In some countries, only 5 or 10% of the adult population have suffered any kind of mental illness in the past year. In the United States, it's 25%. There's a link between inequality and homicide rates. The USA imprisons people at 14 times the rate of Japan. Louisiana imprisons people at 6 times the rate of Minnesota. Of course, Louisiana privatized their prisons. That might have something to do with that. But the bottom line is, according to an article published in the journal Social Science and Medicine, the more equal U.S. states have lower homicide rates and are less likely to use the death penalty. The most important obstacle to achieving sustainability is consumerism, and people in more unequal societies are working harder and harder and harder to keep up appearances, and it's devastating them. Trust. Communities are more cohesive. People trust each more in more equal societies. So, and in fact, here's the list of things where when a society is more equal, like Australia, which tops the chart in median income in the world, when societies are more equal, when they have those higher top tax brackets and they do have national health care and they do have a strong safety, social safety net, you get better results. And in countries like the United States, the United Kingdom, and Singapore, the most unequal countries in the world, you get worse results. Here's the list. This is from the Equality Trust. You can read this over at equalitytrust.org.uk. Physical health. People in more equal societies live longer. Smaller percentage of children die proportion. Mental health. People in unequal societies are more likely to experience mental illness. People in more equal societies, less likely. Drug abuse. People in more equal societies, less likely to become drug addicts or use drugs illegally. Education, kids do better at school in more equal societies. Imprisonment. Unequal societies are harsher. They imprison a higher proportion of people. I'm quoting from equalitytrust.org.uk. Obesity. Obesity is less common in more equal societies, more common in more unequal societies. And in fact, if you look at the individual states of the United States, the states where the obesity levels are the highest are the states where you have the highest inequality. Social mobility, the opportunity, the ability to move out of the class, the economic class, into which you were born and move up. The United States ranks dead last or next to dead last among all the developed countries in the world. We are a crummy place now. Now, it wasn't that case. It wasn't that way before Reagan became president. But now in the United States, we are one of the hardest nations in the developed world to become a self-made person. Trust in community life. Communities are more cohesive and people trust each other more in more equal societies. Violence. Equal societies have lower homicide rates and less child abuse. Teenage births. Teenage motherhood is less common in more equal societies. Child well-being. UNICEF measures of child well-being. Better in more equal societies, worse in unequal societies like the United States. There's even a link between inequality and contributing to global warming and greenhouse gases. So isn't it time for us to say that this 32-year experiment with Reaganomics and dropping taxes on rich people has failed? Not only has failed, but has harmed us terribly? I mean, yeah, we're number 15. Really? Is that what you want? And that's in healthcare. I mean, median income. Healthcare.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
With healthcare, it's like we're number 26. I mean, are these the chants that we really want? I guess Republicans do. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain, however, does not lead to stiff thinking. Not to worry. Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wanted to say that, in keeping with your subject here, I read something I pulled off the Internet. Toronto Globe and Mail last month said that the average net value of the typical Canadian household has gone up. It's now $363,000. It's about $40,000 higher than the average U.S. net value. And that's mostly because of our household income our mortgages and the actual worth of our house has gone down. And because of their regulation, they did not go through the same kind of crisis.
Yeah, their banking industry had no hiccups whatsoever. They did just fine.
Not at
thank
all.
You very
and
much.
Their unemployment rate is 1% lower than ours. If you want to start a small business there, you don't have to worry about providing health care for people.
Right.
If socialism is so bad, I don't know. I just don't understand the talking points of Logan. It's tired. We're sick of hearing it. We've allowed Ronald Reagan and George Bush to ruin our economy, from Ronald Reagan on. And, it is just shown to be exactly what it is. It's just to favor the creation of billionaires at the middle class expense. I'm
right.
Sorry, but I'm middle class. I will always be middle class. And I'm not here in the United States to become a billionaire. I just want to live my life peacefully. And I don't want to be out in the street. I don't want to be thrown out in the street because I get a sickness that, will render me unable to work, so therefore I will have no health care. I know people all around the world, they don't even worry about this kind of thing.
Yep.
They really don't. And if that's socialism, sign me up.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's the question. If socialism is so bad, then why is it that in all the democratic socialist countries, they have a better quality of life than we do? John, thank you. It's easier to become an entrepreneur. It's easier to move out of your social class into another one. Why is it that they have better qualities of life? Elaine in South Miami, Florida. Hey, Elaine, what's up?
I just came into my house, and there's a recording on my machine saying that Barack Obama is a terrorist. He goes under an alias name. They give the name, and they give a phone number to call to donate $3.
Really?
I can play it back for you. I hope you can hear it.
Sure, try it.
All right, hold on.
Mailbox. No new messages. All message played back.
Hi, this is Cancel Services. This is
darn it.
Wrong one.
One.
Wrong one. Okay. So you've got a, stack of messages in there. Yeah. Okay.
Give me one second.
Okay. Do you think it's the next message?
Oh, boy.
Can you hit it? Can you hit the next button or the forward button?
In our government, and you have no idea how deep this goes. The traitor's name is Barry Satoro. Have you heard of him? Probably not. He also goes by the name Barack Obama. That's right. President Obama hasn't always used his current name, and we have evidence that Barack Obama is unconstitutionally serving as president. After intense investigation, we have probable cause that Obama's birth certificate is a computer-generated fraud. And furthermore, when he moved to Indonesia in 1966, he changed his name and renounced his supposed U.S. citizenship, with his religion listed as Islam, meaning he could technically be an illegal alien. Obama doesn't want us to know who he is for a reason. And as a nation's most effective conservative group, we're prepared to move forward and disqualify this imposter before the election. To do this, we must have your help with a donation of even $3 for media time. So please, press 1 to donate $3 or more to expose Obama. Again, press 1 now.
Amazing. Amazing.
They give a phone number.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to play the phone number on the air, Elaine. But that is remarkable. It, you know, the fact of the matter is that when Barack Obama was a little kid, like, you know, five, 6 years old, I think he came back when he was seven, his mother married an Indonesian man. She had separated from his father. And, in fact, his father was only around for a while. You know, he never knew his father. And she married a man from Indonesia. She moved to Indonesia. I believe it was Indonesia. It wasn't Malaysia. Yeah, it was Indonesia. And his name was Sartoro. And Barack Obama called himself Barry back then. And so when he enrolled in elementary school as a second grader in Indonesia, you know, that's what it said. Yeah, it said Barry Satoro or something like that.
I see. That's where they're getting it.
Yeah. I mean, this is where, and it did, and been on that registration card, and people have come up with it, and it does say Muslim, but that's, you know, that was probably his dad's religion. I mean, or in fact, it was certainly his dad's religion. I don't think a 7-year-old's declaration. I don't think 7-year-olds even make declarations.
I see. I saw a film clip on your show probably within the last week, and it showed a man that lost his job because of a bane. And I think that would be the best commercial against Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Just show that commercial as a political ad.
Yeah, well, that actually is an ad, and the Progressive Change Committee, I believe it is. It's one of the progressive groups is out there running it. So, Elaine, thank you for calling and sharing
that
with us.
Thank you. I love your show.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from you. Fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. Inequality. John in Parachute, Colorado, says you want to disagree with me. You go to the front of the line. Thanks for listening to Sirius. Right. What's up?
I've just got two little points on the first one is you're always talking about Fox News having an obvious bias, and I don't disagree with you on that. But I would also like to point out that an organization such as inequality.org probably has their own agenda.
Well, they're not political. It's two social scientists, John Wilkerson and Kate Pickett. They wrote a book. They wrote two books. One is called Why Inequality Matters, and the other is called The Spirit Level. And right. I mean, they're social scientists. That's all they, you know, the math is all right there. All their statistics come from, you know, international surveys done by groups like the United Nations, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the World Bank. They're not promoting any political agenda.
But as Disraeli said, they're lies, damn lies, and statistics. You can make statistics kind of dance any way you want.
Well, I would recommend that before you condemn them, that you go to equalitytrust.org.uk and check it out, or inequality.org, and you can look at the statistics and decide if they're lies or on your own.
I will do that, but I just wanted to ask you to point that out. Secondly, when you were going over the list of countries that are above us in the inequality list,
in median income. Or median wealth, excuse me. The wealth is what you own in the countries that are above us in median wealth. Yes, sir.
Right. Well, when you blew through that list, you just kind of glossed over the fact that several of those countries are in, quote, financial crisis. And how can you do that?
Why not?
How can you just blast through and say that countries that have universal health care and a high income tax and all this other thing, but by the way, they're in financial crisis, do you not see that possibly they're linked?
No, I don't, actually. I don't think that there's a link there at all. I think that what we've seen, what we are witnessing, is the consequence of the deregulation of the world banking community. And it started in the United States about 10 years ago. And that deregulation has led the banksters to basically rip us all off. I mean, you know, they walked off with about $7 trillion worth of wealth here in the United States. It's dozens of trillions of dollars worth of wealth internationally. You've got let me toss this back at you. France just elected a socialist. The way that you know how much trouble a country is in is how much they have to, what the interest rate they have to pay to borrow money, right? Do we agree on that?
That's a good indicator. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, because, you know, if a country's in trouble, you know, when they borrow money, they have to pay more on the treasury bonds because people don't trust that they'll pay it back. So right now, Spain and Italy are paying like 7%, which is damn high. Okay, and the United States is paying, you know, a little over 1%. So people don't figure we're in trouble. At least the world community doesn't figure we're in trouble. But France.
Where's France?
France just elected a socialist president. France, a year ago, France was borrowing in the neighborhood of 1%. They just elected a socialist president who raised the minimum wage, cut the number of working hours every week back, and dropped the retirement age by 3 years, from 60 to 63. In other words, undid all of Sarkozy's so-called reforms. The consequence of that is that more people between 60 and 63 are leaving the employment market, so all kinds of jobs opened up. Young people have job opportunities. People are working fewer hours for the same pay, and with the higher minimum wage, people at the bottom are making more money, so there's more disposable income, there's more demand in their economy. Their economy is doing so well that right now French bonds are not only are they selling at zero, they're actually selling at a minus number. In other words, if you want to borrow, if you want to loan money to France, you have to pay them to loan them money. They're one of the most. Right now, the French bonds are considered the most secure, or among the most secure in the world.
And you would be comfortable with those same kind of moves here in the United States?
Absolutely. When we did those kind of things back in the Eisenhower administration with the Republican Congress and a Republican president, and Dwight Eisenhower maintained a 91% top income tax rate, and we had a minimum wage that was the equivalent of $11 right now in today's dollars, and you had 31% unionization, we had the strongest economy in the world. Yeah, absolutely. I would love to go back to Eisenhower's time.
Even though you'd be in that 91% tax bracket?
I don't think that I would be in the 91% tax bracket. I don't make over $1 million a year.
Come on, Tom. You're not working for minimum wage.
No, I'm doing fine, but I'm not making $1 million a year. That's really where that 91% kicks in. In fact, I'm not making anything close to $1 million a year. So, but that's not my concern. Even if I was, on your first million, you're not paying 91%. You start paying that after the first million. So if I was making that, what would I do? I wouldn't take the money out of my company. I'd hire another person.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Work a few less hours, right? Grow your business. That's how we used to do it in America. Phil Reagan. Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm telling you, when your landlord says we may have some problems with our air conditioning today, pay careful attention. It is 91 degrees in this studio right now. It's 96. Oh, it's 96 outside. No, right in next to you, Shane. Holy cow. I'll bet if I were to raise this thermometer up 3 feet, it would be 96 in here, up to my head level. Anyhow, Ben in Chicago. Hey, Ben, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about Logan. Clearly, he's ideologically blinded. First of all, a government has responsibility not only for individual welfare, but for welfare of the society as a whole.
Well, if I may interrupt you, Logan is an objectivist. Objectivists follow Ayn Rand, and Ayn Rand emphatically stated, and this is pretty much a verbatim quote, there is no such thing as society. There are only individuals collectively.
Well, that follows. Second of all, Ezra Klein in his Wonk blog showed that when you correlate tax rates and jobs, the higher the tax rate, the more jobs that are developed.
Yep.
Because the rich put the money into the buildings of businesses and create jobs.
Well, that's where this guy said, hey, Tom, what's going to happen if you had to pay 91% income tax? I haven't been close to 91%, but I have been in a situation like that in my life where one of my businesses was making a lot of money. I was making a lot of money, and my CPA came to me and said, you really should take less salary and keep the money in the business. And we did. We kept the money in the business, and we expanded the business. We put it into advertising, created more demand for our product. We were able to add another three or four employees and expand the company. And against my initial, and I was in my 20s running this business at that time, against my initial instinct to just take whatever I could out of it. And it was because of the tax law. I mean, that was back in the 70s. That was back when the top tax rate was in the 90% range, or maybe
if
the 74%.
I could add one more thing.
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Right now, we have such huge amounts of money concentrated like never before. You would assume that if that's the appropriate way of handling things, that everything in our society would be superb.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't even have infrastructure that we can rely on. Everything seems to be going down, not improving. It hasn't helped in the way that it ought to have helped.
Yeah, well, that's because starting with the Reagan administration and going all the way to today, there has been a complete neglect. I mean, Reagan started reallocating American dollars into the defense industry, the Star Wars and all this other stuff, and there's been a complete neglect of our infrastructure. Amtrak hasn't had a significant upgrade since 1980. Our highways have not had, we have not built any substantial new highways. There was an attempt to do it this last year, under the Stimulus Act, and the two states that were going to get high-speed rail money, Wisconsin and Florida, both those governors said, no, I'm not going to take that money. That'll create jobs in my state, which will make people happy with the president, and they'll vote for him. We're not going to do that. And you would have had better infrastructure. But we've made no investments in that. We have, Bernie Sanders tells the story of how he was in Vermont and at a place where they were repairing a water system, and the mayor pulled this piece of pipe out of the ground and showed it to Bernie, handed it to Bernie, and said, that was put in before the war. And Bernie says, really? Which war? And the guy, because he could tell the look on the guy's face, there was a punchline. And the guy says, the Civil War. That was put in before the Civil War.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
In terms of Rand and her thing, there is a description that goes like, my money belongs to me. I have no obligation to anybody else. Your money belongs to you. It's not enough for you. Tough.
Yeah.
Is that also part of Rand?
Yeah, Ayn Rand is—it's all about selfishness. It is as John Kenneth Galbraith said, the modern conservative. And thanks for the call. The modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness. It's just that simple. Kevin in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller to your show.
Thank you.
Talk show virgin, as it were.
Okay.
What you just described is eerily like what Herman Cain was saying before. If you are poor, do not blame us. Blame yourself.
Right.
And think of all the young people who are out there struggling. Poor children without enough food to eat. It's disgusting that these people would blame them. And then their parents, their circumstances, their situations. My situation is I used to work my ass off in the American workplace. Mm-hmm. And my dad died after 29 years in a steel mill. He was 50 years old, had a heart attack, a stroke. I think my father would be proud of the work I did in the American workplace. Mm-hmm. But I just can't do it anymore. I was diagnosed with, are you ready for all this? I was diagnosed with coronary artery disease. Arthritis in my spine, something called crepitus in both knees, which is like arthritis,
right.
Anxiety, depression, insomnia, irritable bowel syndrome,
all things that probably flowed from the first couple of things. But your point of all this.
But I would have fallen completely through the cracks and been totally on my own if it hadn't been for food stamps, for Medicaid, for Social Security. I applied for Social Security and got that.
And that's, the, you know, that last thing I think is one of the most important things, Kevin. Most, you get 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, and you have conservatives talking to them saying, yeah, Social Security, it's, you're not going to have any Social Security money until you're 65. It's not even going to be there. Quack, quack, quack. You should just blow it up and hand it over to, you know, go vote for us, and we'll just hand it over to Wall Street. In fact, Social Security, as you have discovered, is a multimillion-dollar insurance policy that every American has from the moment of birth. Little kids born, both their parents die in a car accident, God forbid, they qualify for Social Security survivor benefits. I mean, it literally is there for orphans and widows. Somebody gets disabled so badly that they can't work, and they qualify for Social Security disability benefits for the rest of their lives. My friend Michael Hutchison, he broke his neck. He's paralyzed from the neck down. In his 40s, he's been living, you know, independently. He's been, with Social Security. It's not a lot. He's got some friends who are helping him out. But, you know, it lets him get by. And that is so important. Kevin, thank you for the call. And thank you for sharing your story. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Ann Romney has had the final word. Shane, if you can bring my computer up, let me just play this clip. This is Ann Romney in on ABC News exclusive telling you people what you have.
And we've given all people need to know and understand about our financial situation and about how we live our life. And
there you go. We've given you people all you need to know. So is it all you need to know? And beyond that, how do you make it in America? Is it true what the Republicans are saying that Barack Obama said, that if you build a business, you didn't build it on your own? Now, actually, what he said was somebody invested in bridges and roads. If you built a business, you didn't build that being that infrastructure. He said, you know, somebody else built that infrastructure. But, you know, they've turned this around to say he's saying that you didn't actually build your business. Well, I have a business. Mark Williams has a business. Did we build our businesses? Mark Williams, markwilliams.com, conservative commentator and talk show host. Hey, Mark.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. And I should add, former chair of the Tea Party Express, marktalk.com, the website. Marktalk.com. I'm sorry. I had it wrong. And so, Mark, two things here we can kick around. A, do any of us make it on our own in America?
In the sense that you just mentioned without infrastructure, no. And that's why building infrastructure was built into the Constitution. Otherwise, we don't make it on our own simply because, as you know, as a businessman, it's all about relationships and networking and being in the right place at the right time and sometimes just dumb luck.
Yep.
We don't make it with people handing us things for no good reason that we haven't earned.
Well, actually, Donald Trump did. His father gave him hundreds of millions of dollars, and he blew most of it.
And you, as a student of history, know that the founding fathers didn't really believe in the establishment of family inheritances, like the likes of which we see today.
That's right. None of them left behind fortunes. None of them.
Yeah. And the idea is that they didn't want a royal class, and you and I are very much in agreement on that.
Yeah. Yeah. We shouldn't. We shouldn't be agreeing here, Mark. This is dangerous. The Tea Party and me. It's going to destroy both our reputations. Okay, so we both agree that you can't do it on your own, and we both agree that just, you know, handing things out to people, as Donald Trump's dad did, probably isn't the best idea. Donald Trump had to have several bankruptcies and failures and nearly wiped himself completely out before he got enough good advisors around him to figure out, and good people running his businesses to figure out how to do it without, I think it was after his fourth bankruptcy. So, and this is one of the reasons why Warren Buffett is leaving a relatively small amount of money to his children, you know, hundreds of millions, but not billions. Yeah, it's relatively small. I, you know, bang my head against the wall. But in any case, what do you think about this whole Republican or this Romney campaign attack on Obama, saying that Obama said you didn't been. I don't know if you saw this clip yesterday. I can't play the audio for you. I don't have it here. I should have probably pulled it before the show. But Romney yesterday criticized Obama for saying, if you build a business, you didn't build that, or if you own a business, you didn't build that. When everybody knows Obama was talking about the infrastructure, number one. And then Romney goes on to talk about how we all know people in government who helped us get where we are, our good teachers, our police officers, our, you know, and he actually makes Obama's point. How can he have it both ways?
Well, I don't know that Obama was talking about infrastructure, especially with the way money is being
read his speech.
Everything but infrastructure in this country.
Read his speech. His mistake was using the word that instead of those, because he had two. He said bridges and roads, and then he said, you know, somebody else built that. And that,
well,
of course,
why is the money not going to that? That would be my point. Why is it going to a USDA program to overcome, as they say, self-reliance and pride? To expand the welfare rules. Why am the U.S.
Wait a second. You're talking about food stamps?
Why are we going into those bridges?
You're talking about why do we have food stamps in America? We have food stamps in America because we have cut our poverty rate in half with food stamps.
Why is there a USDA program right now designed, as they say in their own literature, to overcome self-reliance and initiative in order to get more people on the food stamp rolls?
I don't believe that.
That money is far better spent.
Mark, come on. You don't believe that either.
Beg pardon?
The USDA, either you're taking something so out of context as to reverse its meaning, or you've been reading something on the internet.
Oh, no, absolutely not. In fact, the Forsyth County, North Carolina Welfare Office, USDA office, received a gold award for increasing their roles by going out into the countryside and overcoming what they labeled, and this is a quote, mountain pride. What we need to be spending money
on
is,
you know, what they're talking, Mark, you know what they're talking about. Come on, don't weasel word that.
They're talking about, this president gets standing ovations for pitching dependency.
The mountain pride that they're talking about is the, I'm living out here in the woods and I'm not going to take nothing from the government. And, you know, if it was just you all by yourself, not you, Mark Williams, but, you know, you being the 30 or 40 year old guy out in the woods with his gun living on varmints, that would be fine. But he's probably got a 5 or 10 year old kid who doesn't have a decent education, who is not growing up well, you know, with well nutrients, well nourishment, and isn't, and therefore is going to have an IQ 10 points lower than it should have been. And it's just not good for our society to have. Have that.
What serves that kid better? His father having a job and an educational system that educates this kid, or handing him a freebie for the rest of his life?
Well, I'd much rather he had a job. Let's get some government regulations in here to make it harder and more and more difficult, more expensive, like it was before the Reagan administration, to send jobs out of the country.
I would have to agree with that to a certain point. Absolutely.
We keep coming back to this, Mark.
Among those regulations should be a reinstatement of tariffs for imported items.
I agree.
You cannot compete with slave labor in China and have a healthy economy here. It just doesn't work.
We got to start a socialist Democrat Tea Party.
Okay.
Democratic Socialist Tea Party. Okay? I'm a Democratic Socialist. You're a Tea Party guy. And here we are on almost every point other than semantics agreeing. And you know, I all over the country, there are people's heads exploding right now as they're listening to this conversation.
I think we're about to ruin both our reputations.
Yeah, well, you know, what the heck? I think what it says to me is that both of us have a higher commitment to integrity and the truth than we do to partisan politics.
I mean, the bottom line is we both want to get to the same place.
Yeah.
It's the way we get there. We're just arguing over how we get there, the mechanisms of how we get there. I believe that you get there with minimum government involvement, and
but you were just calling for more government involvement and tariffs.
You were just asking
for tariffs. Or how about this? I would submit to you that the government involvement that was put into place in the 1950s, and I think it was during the Truman administration, it might have been during the Eisenhower administration, of making. And this was largely at the urging of General Motors and the other auto manufacturers and their unions, of making health insurance tax deductible to companies but not to people, was done specifically to bind people to employers. And as a consequence, which was fine during the Industrial Revolution when employers wanted to have employees with a 30-year commitment, but it doesn't make any sense in today's modern economy. And what Obamacare does is it breaks that bind. It allows anybody to have health insurance after they leave their employer. So it opens up entrepreneurialism. Isn't that a good thing?
If we disassociated the health care from the government and simply allowed people to buy their policies and give them a deduction for that, they could take it with them wherever they wanted to go.
Well, that's what Obamacare does.
The insurance industry as well. See, the problem with health care costs is the consumer is separated from the pocket that's paying for it. And when you're paying for it, you ask questions. You shop around for prices.
No, I don't.
You make good decisions.
No, I don't.
Else is paying for it.
If I have a pain in my chest, I am not going to call 5 doctors and ask them how much it costs. I'm going to dial 911.
My wife and I do it.
Really? You know, in the middle of a heart attack, you would be calling around asking
not
prices.
In the middle of a heart attack? No, we've done our shopping before the heart attack.
All right.
We've made deals with our doctors and our dentists on down the line.
Well, good on you for doing that.
Our co-pays.
Mark Williams, MarkTalk.com is the website. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Tom.
Always good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I should add, Mark is the former chairman of the Tea Party Express. We will be back. So what do you think of that conversation? Is America maybe getting a little more commonsensical? Welcome back to the True People's Media, talk media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program, and 866-987-THOM. Tom in North Hollywood, California, listening on the KPOJ stream. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think I figured out the whole problem. And the whole problem is no one is saying out there that we, the people, collectively, are the government.
Right.
Everyone's talking about government as being another. I mean, whenever I speak about government, I say we, the people, government.
Right.
Because that's what it is. And I think it started with Ronald Reagan when he said the worst thing, you know, the 8 worst words in the English language is I'm here from the government and I'm here to help you. Because you know what? We should push back right there. When they're talking about bad government, they're talking about bad we are the people.
Yeah. And Shane, we've got a clip from Reagan's inauguration where he says, you know, government is not the solution to the problems. Government is the problem. I mean,
and the thing is, Tom, we don't – right now we talk about government as being another, so people don't feel like they have a part in this government.
Right.
People are collectively the government.
Here's where the poison began. I mean, prior to this point, we all understood that we're all in this together and that generation after generation after generation of Americans fought, bled, died to build this nation, and also known as a government. And then Ronald Reagan came along and said this in his first inaugural address.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Right. And that meme has just been adopted by everybody, including all the lobbyists in this town who are constantly petitioning the government to do what they want.
People should have fought back and said, you know what? Quit talking bad about we the people.
Yeah.
We're not called the I states and the me states. We're the United States, which spells us.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole point is we are the government.
Yep. Excellent point. Tom, thank you for calling and making it. Very well said. Lorraine in Newtown, Connecticut. Hey, Lorraine, what's up?
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak with you. It's like you crawled into my head. A lot of the things of which you discuss, I feel deep down inside also. Mm-hmm. Starting back to the Reagan administration with the FAA, with the breakdown of unions, so on and so forth. My mother, God rest her soul, she was a member of a union for well over 30 years. We had tragedy. Both my parents were basically dying of cancer at the same time. If it weren't for things like the union and the support we received, we would have lost the house. We would have lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing of which I'd like to discuss, so we need the unions. We need that unity. You know, there is strength in numbers.
Yep.
Secondly, I live in one of the most affluent counties in America, Fairfield
mm-hmm.
County.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sin. You can go to Greenwich and Darien and see homes worth millions and millions and millions of dollars. You can travel a few miles up I-95 to Bridgeport, and you're going to see people living in abject poverty.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. It's not healthy for America to have this. It just isn't. Lorraine, very well said. Thank you for calling and sharing your story with us. Ed in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hey, Ed, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Yes, it's nice to talk with you, Tom. My first time.
Thank you.
And I'm a conservative Republican, really, and I do agree with one principle that you've been talking about. I do believe that taxes on the wealthy have to be increased. And I think substantially, especially those making over $1 million a year in income. But I also believe the government spending has to go way down, because somewhere we have to go back and we have to start reducing our deficit tremendously.
Yeah. Well, our military
as a country,
our military expenditures now are about half of our total discretionary budget. In fact, they're over half. It seems like that's a good place to start. And we just wound down a war in Iraq, and the sequestration thing at the end of the year, there's going to be an automatic $500 billion taken out of the Defense Department budget, $500 billion. And that just takes us down to 2006 levels. But I'll tell you, in this town, the lobbyists are hysterical, and the Republicans are all hysterical because lobbyists are feeding them lots of cash. Well, there's some Democrats who are hysterical about it, too. Let me.
Yeah, I tell you what I'm totally in favor of, though, is a strong defense. And no matter what we do, that's the one thing that will keep us safe in this world.
I disagree.
Helping others around the world more than anything else that we can do.
I disagree. Let me disagree with you on that, Ed, and just ask you a simple question. Why is it that Canada doesn't experience terrorism?
Because they're protected by us.
No, we don't have troops in Canada. We don't have an FBI in Canada.
They don't need them.
Why is it that Finland isn't experiencing terrorism? Why isn't Sweden experiencing terrorism?
They're not targets.
They're not experiencing terrorism because they're not occupying foreign countries. If we want to be safe, all we need to do is go back to George Washington's advice of his farewell address, avoid foreign entanglements. I'm with Ron Paul on this.
I would agree with that to a large degree, but I also believe that substantially we should be supporting the free people of the world if they're in trouble. And I think the very fact that we've done that has been a strong point for America.
So if you're in favor of supporting weak countries that are confronting, bad folks around them, or they're just having, as you said, in trouble, are you also in favor of supporting weak people in America who are in trouble? Are you in favor of supporting people who are born poor or live in impoverished areas?
Well, here's one of the problems that we really have had. And over the last 25 years or so, the number of, and I don't mean to make this a racial comment, it's really not intended to be that way, but over 72% of black children are living in a one-parent household.
The number of white kids who are living in one-parent households has gone up dramatically in the last 30 years also. And that seems to have to do more with the demographic shift and the fact that people don't feel like they need to get married anymore. This is not a racial issue. Dig a little deeper into the stats. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. Check out TomHartman.com. You can post you can create your own blog. You can participate in our message boards. You can hang out with the finest minds on earth in our free live chat room. We'll do it on the next break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, wow, it's incredible. You know, when you mention the small handful of wealthy families who pretty much owned El Salvador in the Reagan 80s, you often think of the infamous death squads that their right-wing military government supported. Here's what Tom Brokaw had to report about them in 1983. Now, remember that year. It's important. On NBC's Evening News.
The death squad strike at anyone they suspect of working for the guerrillas or sympathizing with them, even when friends are involved.
These people routinely used rape and murder, including that of children, as a way to suppress the labor movement in that country, as well as routinely disappearing or killing the oligarch's opponents in gruesome ways that were met as warnings to others. Few of the death squad members felt so bad about what they did that they later gave on-the-record testimony about it. For example, at a November 1st, 1989 press conference, former Salvadoran soldier, Cesar Vielman Hoya Martinez, said that some of the military units in the intelligence unit that he was part of participated in what he called heavy interrogation, what you and I would call torture. And after that, it was his job to clean up, to kill the victims. He strangled some. He slit the throats of others. He injected some with rat poison. He said they couldn't use bullets to kill them because they might be traced back to the military. He also said that a U.S. advisor worked at the desk next to his and that he reported to him because the U.S. was providing a monthly budget and teaching torture techniques to the Salvadoran military. Another man who outed the Salvadoran death squads operating in his country in the 80s, and a country, by the way, that was mostly owned and run by about 30 very rich families, was Carlos Antonio Gomez Montano, a paratrooper stationed at the Ilopango Air Force Base. And he said that he sat in on two torture classes in which a 13-year-old girl and a 17-year-old boy were tortured for demonstration and training purposes in January of 1981. He said that one of his officers told him and his fellow soldiers that watching rape and torture, quote, will make you feel like a man, end quote. Now, you're probably asking yourself, why am I talking about El Salvadoran death squads in 1984? Well, because in the midst of all this, a management consultant with deep connections to the Reagan Republican Party was charged by his boss at Bain Consulting to start a brand new company called Bain Capital. And this consultant was set off in search of new investors. Guess who that consultant was? A young guy by the name of Mitt Romney. And guess where old Mitt went off to find investors? El Salvador. Investigative reporter Justin Elliott looked into this, and what he found led him to write an article for Salon titled, and the title pretty much tells the whole thing, The Roots of Bain Capital in El Salvador's Civil War. Romney tapped El Salvador's wealthy families, including one linked to right-wing death squads. As Elliott notes, quote, back in 1984, wealthy Salvadoran families were looking for safe investments as violence and upheaval engulfed the country, end quote. He points out that the U.S. was enthusiastically supporting the right-wing government of El Salvador, and to quote Elliott, the war, which pitted leftist guerrillas against the right-wing government backed by the Reagan administration, ultimately left over 70,000 people dead in that tiny nation. The vast majority of violence, a UN Truth Commission later found, was committed by rightist death squads and the military, which received U.S. training and $6 billion in military and economic aid. The notorious death squads were financed by members of the Salvadoran oligarchy, that'd be those rich 30 families, and had close links to the country's military. The death squads kidnapped, tortured, and killed suspected leftists. End of quote from Salon. So who were the oligarchs who owned and ran El Salvador? Well, according to Elliott, one of the most prominent families was the De Sola family, and Mitt Romney recruited four of their members to provide much of the initial funding for Bain Capital. Again, Elliott writes in Salon, four members of the De Sola family were among the original Bain investors or limited partners in the company, the Globe reported. Their relative and one-time business partner, Orlando De Sola, was an important figure in El Salvador, a well-known right-wing coffee grower with, in his own words, authoritarian visions for his country. De Sola spent time living in Miami, but was also a founding member of the hard-right Arena Party, the right-wing, Arena Party. End of quote. That family was a big part of the ruling party of the country at the time, according to two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Craig Pies, who's quoted by Elliott as saying that Orlando De Sola, quote, was in the inner circle of the group around De Aubusson at the time that De Aubusson was well known to be involved in the death squads. De Sola's name appears on a December 1983 FBI cable as one of 29 people suspected by State Department officials of furnishing funds and weapons to Salvadoran death squads. Now, that, you know, that was the year that Romney was raising money back then, okay? In August of 2007, Mitt Romney told the Miami Herald that he'd traveled to Latin America at least a dozen times in search of startup money for Bain Capital. That money eventually represented about 40% of all the outside cash he brought in. He even bragged about hunting for cash among some of the most authoritarian and brutal regimes in the world, telling Herald reporter Andres Oppenheimer that, quote, the investments for the company that I started, Bain Capital, came largely from Latin America. My largest single investors came from El Salvador, Ecuador, Colombia, and Guatemala. End of quote from Mitt Romney. all of these countries where the then Reagan administration was secretly funding death squads and violent right-wing governments or right-wing insurgencies. So the question, if the media wants to know what rubbed off on Obama when he was sitting in Reverend Reitz's church, how come nobody's asked what rubbed off on Romney when he was sitting with the oligarchs in El Salvador, Colombia, and Guatemala? It may well be that the other shoe is about to drop on the Bain story, and that it isn't about a factory that was shut down with its work sent overseas. Instead, it may be that at its birth, Bain was contaminated with blood money. Keep an eye on this story. Seriously. Joe in Marshall, North Carolina. Hey, Joe. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom. This is Joe. I sent you that shoulder brace back when. Do you remember that?
Oh, bless you. Thank you. Yes, I wore it.
Yeah, back from Vermont. I moved to North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Okay, my thought is this. Let's see if I can put this in a few words. When I lived in Vermont, I found I lived across from these people, and from my daughters, I also know that a lot of people actually move to Vermont and stay there and have children so they can collect benefits there, be on welfare.
Okay.
I'm not opposed to that. I used to live in California in the 60s, and I got help myself when my kids were little.
Sure. And in the 60s, you could get free college in California.
And I worked, you know.
Yeah.
During that time. And
Vermont does have far more generous welfare benefits, if you want to call them that. I mean, your kids qualify for the health care system,
you know?
There.
That's my whole point is I don't really blame. I'm not against people getting help at all.
Mm-hmm.
But if they had people to go out and check on them once in a while, then they would see. I mean, I couldn't sell my house because of the people who lived across the street from me. Because they had horses on 0.64 acres.
Mm-hmm.
They were on welfare. Their kids dropped out of school and had babies.
Mm-hmm.
The mother married a 20-year-old when she was in her 40s, so her name would be changed to get more credit cards.
Yikes.
And these people just used welfare, and their place looked so terrible, I couldn't even sell my house.
Yeah. You know, when Ben Franklin went to London back in the... This is before the American Revolution. It must have been the 1760s.
Uh-huh.
And he came back and he wrote a diary, a long diary entry about this, which I found fascinating. I read it years ago, where he was talking about the British dole. England at that time, the United Kingdom, had a very, very generous welfare system. I mean,
right.
You know, generous by the standards of the 18th century.
Yep.
People didn't starve. And one of the things that he observed was that there were a lot of people who were living on the dole. And he didn't quite know how to square that circle, because on the one hand, he felt that it was really important that you not have people who were so poor that they would spread disease to people like Ben Franklin. In other words, he didn't want to walk down the street and have lepers come up and touch him.
Right.
But on the other hand, he wanted there to be an incentive to work. And I think that all of us agree that there, at least for people who are capable of working. I mean, there are people who are,
definitely
you know, people
that's
who are, yeah, who either physically or psychologically can't.
Instead of, you know,
right. No, I get it. So the question, there's the two questions that we have to ask ourselves as a society are, number one, where is that dividing line? Where is the point where you say, okay, you know, we want to make sure that if somebody's in trouble, that they can get by.
Well, you have to pay people to go out and check on these.
But we don't. Well, maybe. Maybe that's it.
You continue to have them come in and lie to you. You know, you have to go there.
Yeah, and maybe that's it. But then your welfare program becomes very, very expensive. And
I don't know though. You know, because I think a lot of people wouldn't even be on it if they went out. I mean, this house had mold in it. This house was terrible.
Do you think that people really liked living like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she didn't have to work. And she brought her children up that, and her mother had brought her up like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And Vermont is extremely expensive, too.
Yeah.
And the roads are terrible in Rutland. They can't afford to fix them, so...
Oh, I've been through Rutland a number of times.
Yeah.
So number one, we have to figure out what our boundary lines are for welfare programs.
Right.
And number two, we have to figure out how can we create a society where there's not a need for welfare programs. Right? Because my guess would be that poor family that you're describing, if there were still woolen mills in Vermont, if there were still, you know, paper mills in Vermont, if there was still, there used to be a fair amount of industry in Vermont. I mean, it's always been a largely agricultural state, but there used to be a fair amount of industry. That if they were there, those people would probably be working. Because that's what you see. If you go into the neighborhoods where you've got very high levels of poverty, that used to be middle-class industrial neighborhoods, and the industry simply left, you will find people who are living like you described. But they weren't living that way when they could have a job. So I think that there's more to it than just that, Joe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how do we create that society where everybody can have a job? Not only do we incentivize work, we incentivize the keeping of work here in the United States.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused. They're telling me to choose.
Oh, we're cutting through the confusion here. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I just have to respond to that woman from Carolina who was talking about the woman living on the dole and in the moldy house and all that stuff. Can't she recognize mental illness when she sees it? And we do not punish mental illness. We have to do something about it.
Yeah, it may well be that woman was experiencing bipolar disorder or severe depression or something like that.
That is exactly what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when you said, this is what burns me about all these people who talk against the welfare system. You know, this is what keeps them off the street. It keeps a lot of people off the street. They don't know the numbers that keeps off the street.
Right. Very well made, Monica. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Jason in Downers Grove, Illinois. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment about some of the things you were saying before. I think what it basically boils down to is basically like everything else is just the money situation. Like I heard a caller making a comment as to why we shouldn't help the poor because, you know, there's single families, this and that. And,
right.
You know, we have to remember that we're animals first and humans second. I mean, what happens, if you think about it, if you start gutting people's paychecks, they're going to think about self-preservation. And then at that point, you have people running out the door because it's not that they don't want to love these beings. It's just that they, you know, all of a sudden panic because they start thinking about themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just a comment I wanted to throw out there. And then as for the solution for it, I mean, it might seem extreme, but when you think about it, I hear a lot of the term, you know, class warfare, social warfare, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And before a lot of, like, great, you know, changes happened, like Civil War, you know, the Revolutionary War, you know, people actually went to battle. And
yep.
Really, you can't do that these days because if you want to protest, like in Chicago, you have to have a permit now. If you don't have a permit to protest, which kind of defeats the purpose in the first place, you can get put in jail. So it's almost like they have the muscle to stop any kind of power of any kind from coming up and protesting.
Except it's not any kind of power. They have the muscle to stop street protests, but there's a lot of other ways to protest, and there's a lot of other ways to participate. I don't think that they should have done that. You know, I disagree with that level of governmental power personally. But I get your point. I think it's well made. Thank you very much. Ray in Chicago. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. The guy before who was questioning those correlations between health problems and societal problems and disparity of income, it makes total sense in some ways because the bigger the difference between people's expectations and reality, the more emotion they generate. And when you've got this vast disparity of income just kind of flaunted everywhere you look, I mean, the people who don't have much have a lot of things to be upset about and a lot of struggles and stuff. But then it's like that's flaunted right in front of them, so it creates so much more emotion than it might otherwise. Does that make any sense?
It not only does it make a lot of sense, I can give you an example. I mean, it creates anxiety. It screws with your cortisol levels, the hormone, the stress hormone. The example was, this was a study that was done back in the 70s, and it was fast. I remember reading it, you know, and just being blown away by it. The scientist who did it was observing squirrels in his neighborhood, and he noticed that all the squirrel nests appeared to be about the same size. And so he wondered, what would happen if he went out and made one of the squirrel nests larger? And so he went out and he added about 20%, because the squirrel nests are made out of leaves, right, up in the trees. So he added about 20% more leaves to one of the squirrel's nests. He made that squirrel's nest larger. And then he just took photographs and tracked all the other squirrels' nests that were within about a quarter mile of there, that were within sight of that, or where the squirrels interacted with each other. all the other squirrels in that neighborhood started then increasing the size of their nests. We are wired to keep up with the Joneses. It's in our biology. And when and if you look at television from the 50s and the 60s, the old Jackie Gleason show, the old Lucille Ball show, the old Mary Tyler Moore show, and you know, Rob Petrie and all that stuff, all of them, they lived in middle-class houses. Jackie Gleason lived in a fourth-floor cold water walk-up in New York City. Didn't even have hot water. The Lucy show, they had an apartment in Manhattan, and it was a small apartment. And you know, right up until the 80s, basically, most television programs, the sitcoms, the dramas, all of them, all of those programs, the people that you saw were people like middle America. And then in the 80s, with this whole Greed is Good and Reagan thing, Dallas took off, and all of a sudden it was shows about rich people. And even the sitcoms that, you know, started having rich people, right? And not so much rich people, but the houses changed to be like, you know, the million-dollar house in Hollywood kind of thing. And it was no longer the Beaver Cleaver house. And the consequence of that is that average Americans look at that and think, you know, that's the standard. That's the squirrel's nest next door, right? That's the standard that I have to measure myself against, and I don't measure up. And that then creates that those higher levels of stress hormones, low in men, lower levels of testosterone, crashing emotions, you know, more violence, more concern, and actually all of those things in aggregate suppress your immune system.
A friend of mine was in a Peace Corps, and I always remember him saying that people who lived in the, you know, rural areas and stuff in South America were content until they got transistor radios and started hearing about all the wonderful things in the city. And then all of a sudden their discontentment level went up, and then they all rushed into the cities and created even more problems. And it wasn't what they expected it to be. I just keep thinking about that, you know, the way you look around and there's so much of this wealth around, and there's so many people who don't have access to it. That's going to create more, you know, problems with violence and everything else, crime, you name it.
There's a good example of that. It's in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, about an Amazonian tribe that was doing just fine, thank you very much. And some anthropologists went to visit them and check out what was going on with them. And one of the gifts that they gave them was a television. And, you know, that was it. That ended. That generation ended the living in the jungle lifestyle. And, you know, it was extremely, actually, it wasn't the anthropologists who gave them the TV, now that I recall. It was the loggers who were trying to build roads through there. The anthropologists were observing the process. But it was the TV that destroyed their culture. And frankly, I think that, you know, even though I'm on TV, I think the TV is a pernicious force. We didn't have TV for 18 years while our kids were growing up. Ray, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, I'm going to repeat a call that I have made in the past, but with a little more eloquence, I think, this time. Just a few weeks after trying to take health care away from more than 100 million Americans, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia sat down with CNN's Piers Morgan. And what followed was a discussion with a man who's not only out of touch with the values this nation was founded on, but also out of touch with the implications of his decisions on the high court, and out of touch with the ethical conduct of a sitting justice. Here's just a few highlights. To begin with, Justice Scalia was asked which of the decisions he's presided over on the court has been the most contentious. Here was his answer.
Well, I guess the one that, you know, created most waves of disagreement was Bush versus Gore, okay? That comes up all the time, and my usual response is get over it.
Get over it. Right. It's just, to begin with, well, and that's a lie. You know, Scalia saying, he actually went on to say that, well, in fact, here, clip number two, this is the other half of that.
Oh, no regrets at all, especially since it's clear that the thing would have ended up the same way anyway. The press did extensive research into what would have happened if what Al Gore wanted done had been done county by county, and he would have lost.
Yeah, and well, actually, that's not quite a lie. Here's Scalia telling the very, very carefully parsed truth. The New York Times reported on November 12, 2001, after it and a consortium of news organizations conducted their own recount in Florida, that Gore actually won that state. The Times wrote, and I quote, "If all the ballots across the state, if all the ballots had been reviewed under any of seven single standards and combined with the results of an examination of overvotes, Mr. Gore would have won," end quote. The Times looked at all the various scenarios, dimple Chad, pimple Chad, undervotes, overvotes, intent of the voter, hanging Chads, everything, and concluded, quote, "All the other combinations likewise produced additional votes for Mr. Gore, giving him a slight margin over Mr. Bush," end of quote. You would think that the revelation that the wrong guy was sitting in the White House would be front page news. Instead, it was buried in the 17th paragraph in a story misleadingly titled, "Study of Disputed Florida Ballots Finds Justices Did Not Cast the Deciding Vote." Now, here's why that headline was used and what he was trying to say. The article in the New York Times says that, but correctly, by the way, points out that Al Gore, when Al Gore sued originally in Florida, in the Florida courts, he wanted Dade County and Broward County, and there's one other county, three counties down in Florida, he wanted them recounted. And when the recount was done, well, let me finish. So he wanted three counties recounted. The court looked at that and said, you know, there's enough discrepancies here, we should recount the entire state. The Supreme Court for the state of Florida said, no, we're not going to just recount a couple of counties like you asked for, Mr. Gore. We're going to recount the entire state. Now, ironically, and that's a word that the New York Times used, had we only looked at the counties that Gore originally asked to be recounted, Gore would have lost. But because the New York Times and all these other organizations looked at all of the state, they said, you know, by any measure, Gore would have won. But let me play that Scalia clip one more time, clip number two here, where Scalia points out, now keep in mind, the Supreme Court of the state of Florida said every ballot needs to be counted. And when the New York Times counted every ballot in the state, Al Gore won in 2000. But what Scalia is saying, which is what the New York Times was saying, is that if the only ballots, only the ballots that Al Gore had originally asked to be recounted, if only those were recounted, then Gore still would have lost, which is true, if they had just recounted those three counties. But he's ignoring the fact, Scalia, this is so weaselly, Scalia is ignoring the fact that the recount that the Supreme Court stopped was the one that the state Supreme Court in Florida had ordered, which was the entire state, which would have given the election to Gore. Now, knowing all that, listen to Scalia again, how he very carefully says we wouldn't have changed the outcome based on what Gore wanted, not on what the Supreme Court of the state of Florida wanted.
Oh, no regrets at all, especially since it's clear that the thing would have ended up the same way anyway. The press did extensive research into what would have happened if what Al Gore wanted done had been done county by county, and he would have lost.
And he would have lost. So, you know, had they done this three-county vote, yeah, Al Gore still would have lost. So, anyhow, the New York Times pointed out that if you count every vote in the state, Al Gore won. If you just counted three counties, Al Gore loses. But the Supreme Court in the state of Florida said recount the whole state. Al Gore was legitimately elected president in 2000 in Florida. But Scalia, the Supreme Court, blew that up. Now, why was that story buried in this, you know, the 17th paragraph in the New York Times? It was buried because 9/11 had just happened. It took the Times a year to count the ballots. And the Times didn't want to diminish Bush's claim to the White House in the middle of a national crisis. So the stolen election stood. And today, 12 years later, after two illegal wars and economic depression, numerous scandals from outing a CIA agent, politicizing the Justice Department, to outright war crimes, all on Bush's watch. Justice Scalia tells America to get over it. To get over it. Well, for the thousands of families who have lost a loved one in war, the millions who've lost their homes, the tens of millions who've lost their jobs, not so easy to get over it. To add insult to injury, here was Justice Scalia defending the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, the one that sold off our government to a small handful of billionaires and transnational corporations.
I think Thomas Jefferson would have said the more speech, the better. That's what the First Amendment is all about. So long as the people know where the speech is coming from.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson just did a barrel roll in his grave. Not only would Jefferson, who feared the power of an aristocracy, the super rich, more than any of the other founding fathers, not only would he not have agreed with Citizens United on principle, he also would have disagreed with the enormous power grab that the court made that day. Because in Citizens United, Scalia and the four other right-wing justices rewrote a century of established election law going all the way back to the Tillman Act of 1907, which banned corporate contributions to politicians. Here's what Jefferson thought about the Supreme Court overturning laws like McCain-Feingold that had been passed by Congress and signed by the president. He wrote to John Adams' wife in 1804, "The opinion of the Supreme Court, which gives the justices the right to decide what laws are constitutional and what not, not only for themselves, but for their sphere of action, but for the legislature and executive branches also in their spheres, would make the judiciary a despotic branch." And as Jefferson wrote to Virginia Supreme Court Justice and Patrick Henry's father-in-law, Spencer Rowan, in 1819, "If the judiciary is the last resort in relation to the other departments of the government, that indeed is our Constitution, a complete suicide pact. The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary." And here we have Scalia manipulating this as a thing of wax. You know, Jefferson thought it should be left up to we the people, not nine kings on the high court, and certainly not corporations and the super rich. He just, you know, he was just absolutely all about that. So what do we do? Here's Justice Scalia on national television lying about the Bush v. Gore decision that he led, and completely mischaracterizing Thomas Jefferson. What should we do? In my opinion, we should be impeaching Scalia. I would love to see an impeach Scalia movement in the House of Representatives. You might want to call your member of the House of Representatives and ask if they would consider doing that.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, it is mind-boggling when a sitting justice on the Supreme Court goes on national television and lies by omission to the American people. Ah, song for Anthony Scalia, indeed. Apparently he's got a book out and he's doing a book tour right now. Should Supreme Court justices, I mean, if they won't allow us to have a camera in the Supreme Court, should they be able to do book tours? He asks rhetorically. Ed in Portland. Hey, Ed, thanks for listening to KPOJ. What's up?
Hey, you know, I've been a disability evaluator here in Portland for 20 years. Plus mm-hmm. that, I see no one I would trade places with. I mean, I see hurting kids, some of them unable to speak because of birth problems and so on. I see low-functioning folks. I see folks after accidents and so on. For a paltry several hundred dollars a month for a Social Security disability, there is no one I would change places with. And the idea that people think that these folks are scamming or, you know, just gliding by on stuff, they don't know the reality. They don't know the depth of the pain or the depth of the need.
Yeah, very well said, Ed. Thank you very much. And thank you for reminding me of that. I worked in that field peripherally back in the late
70s. And your poor friend, too. My gosh, what an awful thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is. Thank you, Ed. Thank you very much for the call. Wayne in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Wayne. Thanks for listening to KPOJ.
Hi,
what's
Tom. I've got a comment on your conservative guest, and I enjoyed those conversations, by the way, because you're mm-hmm. pretty temperate.
Thank you.
He made the prior arrangements with his doctor and dentist. And I just want to comment that I've made prior arrangements with the oncologist, the orthopedic surgeon, the MRIs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's called Medicare.
There you go. Yeah, I've never tried to negotiate price in medicine, but I've always, pretty much most of my life, I've always had health insurance, and it hasn't been an issue. And I just, you know, I remember so well living in Germany, and one of our kids had a problem. We walk into the local doctor's office, and you know, bang, instant treatment. I had a problem. It turned out it was a panic attack. I thought I was having a heart attack. And they took me to the hospital, and they did all the tests and everything, and everything was fine. I had no idea even what a panic attack was at that time. And I haven't had one since then, thank God.
Yeah,
but, you know, it was just
my life,
strange place, strange time.
Another comment.
Yeah.
I spent my life, for most of my life, working in hospitals. I worked in 9 of them over the years, and spent about 30 years at it. Every single one of them back then was non-profit. It was a state hospital or a Catholic hospital.
They were required by state law to be non-profit.
Hospital, community hospitals. I never worked at a totally private hospital. It just wasn't such a thing.
Yeah.
I just can't believe it, how it's changed.
That change happened in the 1980s. That came along with Reagan, and in fact, that's how Bill Frist's daddy made $3 billion with AHA, I think it is, or whatever the name of the company
HCA
was.
HCA bought one of the hospitals
HCA.
I worked at
killed
it in about a year.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they did, is they bought up public hospitals, they bought up nonprofit hospitals that paid decent wages and provided good services and squeezed all the blood out of them, cut everybody's pay, cut the staffing down, you know, ran them like a business, and Bill Frist, you know, and his daddy made billions, literally, with a B, billions. His family became billionaires, and our healthcare system became very, very expensive. Excellent point, Wayne. Thanks for the call. Jason in Chicago. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I've got a question about the Romney tax returns. Mm-hmm. I don't want to give the bad guys any ideas, but is there anything that would prevent him from just fabricating false ones and releasing them? I mean, considering that these aren't subject to the Freedom of Information, there's no way we could independently verify them.
Well, he's sort of doing that with the ones that he released for 2010, in as much as he acknowledges that he has a Swiss bank account, but he didn't release the part of the tax return that says what's in it. And so, you know, he's already, you know, the one that he's returned is very incomplete. And then his wife is being interviewed on national television, and she says, you know, we've given you people all that you're going to get, or all that you need. This you people thing, I mean, the last time you people was used in American politics at the presidential level was Ross Perot speaking to the NAACP, and they all got what he meant. And, you know, Ann Romney, you should check that interview out. Take, you know, watch that. I think that it'll raise your eyebrows. Thanks a lot for the call, Jason. Rich in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Rich, says you want to disagree with me. What's up?
I disagree with that. Hopefully I can show you the error in your ways.
Okay.
I'd like to say that flat tax. I think everyone should pay their fair share. But why should somebody pay more? When you drove to work today, the street that you drove on, the police, the fire, does it cost more for somebody who makes $30,000 a year to drive on the street than it does for somebody who makes $1 million?
Yes.
I mean, no.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it absolutely does. Somebody who's making $1 million.
Hey, no. Explain that to me. This is fantastic.
Yeah, if you'll listen, I'll explain it. You got to listen, though. Okay? Somebody who's making $1 million a year is using the commons more heavily than somebody who's making more than $30,000 a year. If they're driving, they're probably you're not going to let me finish. If they're driving, they're probably driving a bigger vehicle.
If I own a house that is 1,000 square feet, and a guy who makes $30,000 a year has a house, okay,
right,
that's $1,000 square feet, and all of a sudden that my house burns down, their house burns down. Does it cost more money to put my house down if we have the same identical house?
Well,
no.
you probably wouldn't have the same identical house.
No, that's your assumption, but maybe I live that way.
Okay,
well,
then that's why we have property taxes that are based on the value of the house.
No. It doesn't matter how much I make. It's what I bought. It doesn't matter if I make $1 million a year.
The original point that I was trying to make to you, Rich, that you keep interrupting me and you don't want to hear, so I'm going to drop your call and you can just listen to me on the air, because we have less than a minute here. I do want to finish this thought, is that somebody who makes $1 million a year much more heavily uses the commons than does somebody who makes $30,000 a year. the mechanism by which they're making that $1 million and the $1 million itself. They are heavier users of our court system. They are heavier users of our police system. They are heavier users of, you know, their wealth in and of itself. Just the protection of that wealth more heavily uses our commons. And with regard to roads, that's a lousy analogy because gas tax is what pays for our roads. And gas tax is based on how you drive. And with regard to houses, that's a lousy analogy because houses are based on property taxes. But if you're talking about income, income tax pays for our courts and our IRS. Yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
People with higher incomes are more heavily using the commons and leaving less of it available to the rest of us, and therefore should pay more in tax. Very Lodophagously ugly, the good. U.S. District Judge Todd Campbell. Yesterday, Campbell ruled that officials in Rutherford County, Tennessee, need to stop preventing Muslims from worshiping in a newly constructed mosque. The legal battle over use of the mosque first began in 2010 when county residents filed a suit claiming that Islam is not a real religion, that it's a seditious cult intended to impose Islamic religious law on the U.S. government. America used to be a country that was welcoming of all faiths and cultures. It's time we got back to those ideals. The bad. Congressman Steve King. Republican King is sponsoring an amendment to the House Farm Bill that allows forms of animal cruelty, confining pregnant pigs so tightly they can't move a single limb. But as horrible as this all sounds, Representative King is very proud of his work. King told the Daily Caller that his legislation, quote, wipes out everything they, the animal rights advocates, have done with pork and veal, end quote. Of course, this is nothing new for King, the same man who once spoke out against anti-dog fighting legislation and said that the Humane Society prevents production agriculture. And the very, very ugly Mike Huckabee. On yesterday's edition of the Huckabee Report, Huckabee was talking about the Boy Scouts of America's recent decision to continue discriminating against gay scouts and leaders. In the course of a conversation with a caller, Huckabee basically argued that the BSA made the right decision because, he said, gays molest children. Right. Numerous studies have shown that pedophilia and homosexuality have absolutely no relationship. Continuing to propose this conservative anti-gay myth is incredibly hurtful to the LGBT community and very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. David, Pittsburgh. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I used to listen to you on the radio here way back in 2007.
Oh, yeah.
And now I have to...
I forget the call letters in the station here. That used to carry Progressive Radio in Pittsburgh. But, yeah, so what's up?
I just want a lot of notes I just wrote down here, just real quick.
Pick one, please.
Well, okay. Well, let's. I'll just go to the healthcare one. Only because what does the IRS have anything to do with health care?
If you're going to have a system where you say the freeloaders, the free riders, actually, let me use Mitt Romney's term, the free riders. If you're going to have a system where the people who are young and healthy and making a good income and choose not to have health insurance, and therefore when they get in a car accident, you and I pay for it. If you're going to have a system where those free riders are allowed to not have health insurance, and of course you can't force people to have health insurance, then the least you can do is charge them a small amount of money annually, $600 a year, $695 a year, and put that into a fund to pay for all those hospital visits, those ER visits. And somebody has to collect that money. And there's only one agency in the federal government that has the authority to collect money from you and me, and that's the IRS.
I was just also curious, too, if government spending equals jobs and a great economy, how come the close to $1 trillion stimulus didn't make us the greatest, wealthiest country, the most lowest unemployment? What went wrong, Tom?
It was
$1 trillion. What went wrong?
It was half the size it should have been. Paul Krugman and other good economists pointed out that, and Jared Bernstein, the guy who actually wrote the stimulus bill, we had him on this program, And he pointed out that there was a $2.7 trillion hole blown in the side of the economy by Bushonomics. $2.7 trillion. Let me finish my sentence here. Okay, I'm going to finish my sentence without you. I don't know if we got a problem here. People can't hear me talking or what. But here's the thing. And I hate cutting callers off because I don't want to be like those right-wing wackadoodles who, as soon as you think you're winning the argument, they cut you off. Because I'm not cutting you off because you think you're winning the argument. It's because I'm going to make this damn point. Or maybe I'm not. I forgot what I was talking. Where was I on this? Oh, it was the stimulus, $2.7 trillion. Jared Bernstein and Paul Krugman both pointed out we had a $2.7 trillion hole blown in the side of our economy. We were losing 700,000 jobs a month. 700,000 jobs a month. $2.5 trillion hole. Obama comes along and says, let's do at least $1.5 trillion stimulus. The Republicans say, no way, we won't go for anything over $800 billion. And he says, okay, we'll do $800 billion. It's a third of what we need, but at least it'll stop the hemorrhaging. Right? It's like a tourniquet on a bleeding vein or artery. So then Republicans say, but, you know, a third of it has to be tax cuts. Because we're all about tax cuts. And so Obama, you know, the only way he could get it passed. So what we ended up with was functionally a $500 billion stimulus to try and fill a $2.7 trillion hole. And what that $500 billion stimulus did, and you could look at do the math, just look at the charts. We were in January, we lost 700,000 jobs. In February, we lost something like 650,000 jobs. In March, it was 700,000 jobs. The stimulus goes into effect. And immediately we're down to losing 100,000 jobs. Next month we're losing like 80,000 jobs. The next month after that we lost maybe 20,000 jobs. And then by the month after that, I don't have the chart in front of me. I'm doing this from memory, so these numbers are just like for example. These are not real numbers. But and then the month after that, we started actually creating jobs, the private economy, and we have now had 20, either 4 or 7 consecutive months. I think it's 27 consecutive months of private sector job creation. Now, it hasn't been as good as it would have been had Obama been able to do what Franklin Roosevelt could do, which was patch a $2 trillion hole in the economy with $2 trillion. But at least it got us out of bleeding to death. So hopefully you heard that and it appropriately answered your question. Let's see here. Merritt. In Encinitas, California. What's up?
Hi, it's actually Marit.
Marit, my apologies.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking this call. I am a psychologist. I'm calling from Encinitas, and I live in San Diego County. I'm a doctor of psychology, a dietitian, and I am very, very tired of hearing poor people characterized as dirty, unmotivated, lazy, stupid, and having people applaud this alleged social service safety net that is out there for us.
Right.
I'd like to tell you about how the social service safety net has worked for me, if I may.
Sure.
In 2003, I had a practice as a psychologist and a dietitian. I have 5 college degrees, so I'm not stupid. I was hit by a car. A man ran a stop sign and received a traumatic brain injury.
Ouch.
In 2005... my stepmother, I'm an only child, and my father was in a dementia and dying. My stepmother got me to sign some papers. I didn't know what they were. I thought she was going to help me. She ended up, while I was in the hospital, without my knowledge, selling my home, nice 3-bedroom, 3-bath home, taking the money, spending a little bit of the money on a trailer where I'm living right now, and basically I was moved to this trailer and left. I have been living on $800 a month, Social Security disability. It's very difficult to live on $800 a month.
Right.
I've been receiving a whole $16 a month for food with
right.
food stamps.
Right.
$16 a month. In attempting to get help through this social service program, help in my home, I was sexually molested by one individual in my home. That person was paid by San Diego County. The next person stole over $100,000 worth of jewelry, which is all the jewelry my father gave me.
Right, Marla, this is turning into a more substantial story than talk radio can serve. Your point, though, is that
I just want to say that not every poor person is dirty, stupid, and the social safety net is not there for us.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. And it needs to be strengthened. And ending welfare as we know it and, you know, was not a good idea. Thank you very much, Marla, for the call. I wish you well. Judy in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hey, Tom.
Hi,
Gore v. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually
Bush v. Gore. It was George Bush who brought the lawsuit.
I thought Gore sued him. Anyway,
no.
Fallujah County, Florida.
Yes.
You mentioned this was an HBO documentary, and it featured that lady that you talked about that went on with Howard Dean and showed up.
Bev Harris, yeah.
To be hacked. Well, there's another dimension to this. They did some tests on these machines, and this is in relation to that election of 2004.
Right.
It had to do with the data memory cards.
Mm-hmm.
That they fed into I believe this was off the paper ballots, and then they would take the machine and they'd run what looked like a cash register tape, and it would show all zeros next to the votes to clear it.
Mm.
And then they'd feed all the paper ballots in, and then they'd print out another tape.
Right.
Well, what they did was they checked, they used these data memory cards. It's kind of like if you put a flash drive in a computer to save something on it.
Mm-hmm.
So from all the polling places, and then they take it to the central tabulating machine to do the final count. So what they discovered, and they did this through tests, that these data cards had executable code. And what they were doing was they were subtracting votes from Gore and from Bush.
Yeah, I remember when that happened, and you can find documentation of that over at blackboxvoting.org. Thank you, Judy, for that. And thanks for reminding us all that we still have a problem with the fact that our election system has been privatized of all things.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, do you think that there's going to be any media response to Scalia lying about Bush v. Gore? Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on our Capitol cam. They're lowering the flags on the Capitol. I guess the session is out. I don't know the details of how all that works. It's fascinating, though. 866-987-THOM. Ludwig in New York City. Hey, Ludwig, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say quickly, you know, when people call who disagree with you and they don't allow you to speak, it's because I think deep down inside, they know right from wrong, and they know that big corporations and banks are controlling our Congress and these big families that control all the monopolies in the United States. And I don't think any of your fans, and I'm one of those, judges you when you disconnect them because they just, I mean, they can't even listen to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the kind of rules of talk radio, not rules, it's the wrong word, but one of the realities of talk radio is that the host almost always wins because they have the ability to cut off the caller. And I try not to use that. I try to have a conversation with somebody until we have either agreed to disagree or one or the other of us says, yeah, that must be the way it is. And, you know, people trying to filibuster me just doesn't make that practical. So.
Yeah, you do a great job. And
Thank you. And, you know,
people notice that. And I just wanted to tell you that.
Well, thank you. Is that what you called about? Or did you have?
Oh, no. That's
okay.
The other thing I wanted to mention to you was, Tom, is, you know, someone who, say, starts a landscaping business and they become successful enough where after 20 years of hard work, they have, you know, they're worth, say, $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at someone like the Rockefeller family where, you know, they have something like the Council on Foreign Relations, which controls the Congress. Do you think it's like a divide and conquer to mix those two types of people? Do you think that's what the media's idea was, to confuse people to think that if you earn $1 million as a landscaper versus,
these big corporations that put monopolies and they put all these regulations on people who are regular millionaires. Do you think that's...
I don't think there's anybody earning $1 million as a landscaper.
Oh, there's a family where I live in Connecticut where, I don't want to say their name, but yeah, they have one of the biggest houses and their family, they have, you know, they do a great job. I mean, I know that's just one poor example.
So, in other words, they've got a landscaping company and they've got people who work for them. So they're no longer doing landscaping, and what they're doing is business administration.
Correct. That type of thing.
Okay.
Do you think there's a difference between that and someone like a Rockefeller family who has all this control over, you know, what goes on in the government?
I'm not completely sure I understand the premise of the question. I mean, the fact is that anybody who's earning $1 million a year, who's a multimillionaire, has, because of Citizens United and other Supreme Court decisions, has a disproportionate amount of influence on our government. It shouldn't be that way. And they're getting a free ride by and large with regard to their taxes. And they can scam the game the way Mitt Romney did and pay 13.9%. That said, I don't get the distinction, and unless you're talking about the Rockefeller family as inherited wealth, because most of the modern all of the modern Rockefellers, John D. was back in the 1890s. So
let me rephrase it a different way. I have a friend who does derivatives, and his business is great. He wanted to open up more agencies around the country. He wanted to hire more people. And all of a sudden, these regulators came to him and said, you can't hire anyone for a couple of years. You can't invest for a couple of years.
Doing derivatives?
Yeah. Actually, I mean, he's a famous person. Peter Schiff from Euro Pacific Capital.
Yeah.
He tells his story on the radio and how...
it was derivatives that blew up our economy. So if regulators are going to this guy and saying, no, we're not going to let you blow up the economy again, I'm all for that.
Well, even if it's cookies. Say it's cookies.
Well, cookies have never blown up the economy, to the best of my knowledge.
Well, no. I'm not talking about whether they blow up the economy. I'm talking about people who start companies, and then if their company is successful, the larger companies have the control over distribution and things of that nature, where they have the control on whether the smaller companies can expand. That's
right. So, okay, what you're discussing is the concept or the problem of monopoly and capitalism.
That's what I'm trying to say. And
monopoly is a terrible, it's a cancer in capitalism. That's why the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1881 to end monopoly. And we had done a relatively good job, on and off more or less over the roughly 100 years from the time the Sherman Act was passed in 1881 until 1981, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing it. And no president since him has seriously enforced it. And that's why, ask anybody who's old enough to remember America before 1981. Before 1981, every town had its own, every store was locally owned. You had mom and pop businesses, you had dry cleaners and restaurants and car repair shops that had literally been in families for generations. You had strip malls where every store was a locally owned store. Now what do you have? You have malls that are nothing more than chains that you could see, the same ones in San Diego and the same ones in Buffalo and the same ones in Tampa and or in some little town in Mississippi. And the downtowns all look the same. So, yeah, I would say that it's extremely pernicious. It's extremely destructive. I want to grab one more call here, Ludwig, before the end of the show. Pete in Victoria, Texas. Hey, Pete, we have a minute left. It's yours.
All right. Well, I'll make it quick. I think you give out too many facts, because I'm in the heartland of Republicans down here in South Texas. And the best thing that works for me is I ask them two questions, and all of them's mouth open and they can't answer me. Is one, do you think Mitt Romney would have a problem firing you? And two, do you think he'd have a problem sending your job overseas?
Right, and here's the third question.
All the other facts doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, here's one third question you might want to toss into that. Do you think that Mitt Romney would buy a corporation, would buy a company, because that was his business, only looking at 1 year's worth of their tax returns?
Yeah, well, that's complicated. I'm around.
Yeah, but I get you. You're absolutely right. You talk about the bottom line. Do you think Mitt Romney would fire you? Do you think he'd send your job overseas? Of course he would. Pete, you're absolutely right. That should be the essence of the whole thing. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator, Senator Bernie Sanders. Well, I call him America's Senator. He calls himself Vermont Senator. We'll be here talking about the important issues of the week, and get your questions ready, because he'll be taking your calls as well. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday. What do you want to talk about? And the best of the rest of the news and your calls. Right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. Remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.